Fortunately, there was a technique that enabled us to determine the roughness or softness of a candidate landing site. Radar. A very rough place would scatter radar from Earth off to the sides of the beam and therefore appear poorly reflective, or radar dark. A very soft place would also appear poorly reflective because of the many interstices between individual sand grains. While we were unable to distinguish between rough places and soft places, we did not need to make such distinctions for landing site selection. Both, we knew, were dangerous. Preliminary radar surveys suggested that as much as a quarter to a third of the surface area of Mars might be radar dark and therefore dangerous for Viking. But not all of Mars can be viewed by Earth-based radar, only a swath between about 25 degrees north and about 25 degrees south. The Viking orbiter carried no radar system of its own to map the surface. There were many constraints. Perhaps we feared too many. Our landing sites had to be not too high, too windy, too hard, too soft, too rough, or too close to the pole. It was remarkable that there were any places at all on Mars that simultaneously satisfied all our safety criteria. But it was also clear that our search for safe harbors had led us to landing sites that were, by and large, dull. When each of the two Viking orbiter-lander combinations was inserted into Martian orbit, it was unalterably committed to landing at a certain latitude on Mars. If the low point in the orbit was at 21 degrees Martian north latitude, the lander would touch down at 21 degrees north, although by waiting for the planet to turn beneath it, it could land at any longitude whatever. Thus, the Viking science teams selected candidate latitudes for which there was more than one promising site. Viking 1 was targeted for 21 degrees north. The prime site was in a region called Chrysi, Greek for the land of gold, near the confluence of four sinuous channels thought to have been carved in previous epochs of Martian history by running water. The Chrysi site seemed to satisfy all safety criteria, but the radar observations had been made nearby, not in the Chrysi landing site itself. Radar observations of Chrysi were made for the first time, because of the geometry of Earth and Mars, only a few weeks before the nominal landing date. The candidate landing latitude for Viking 2 was 44 degrees north. The prime site, a locale called Cydonia, chosen because, according to some theoretical arguments, there was a significant chance of small quantities of liquid water there, at least at some time during the Martian year. Since the Viking biology experiments were strongly oriented toward organisms that are comfortable in liquid water, some scientists held that the chance of Viking finding life would be substantially improved in Cydonia. On the other hand, it was argued that on so windy a planet as Mars, microorganisms should be everywhere if they are anywhere. There seemed to be merit to both positions, and it was difficult to decide between them. What was quite clear, however, was that 44 degrees north was completely inaccessible to radar site certification. We had to accept a significant risk of failure with Viking 2 if it was committed to high northern latitudes. It was sometimes argued that if Viking 1 was down and working well, we could afford to accept a greater risk with Viking 2. I found myself making very conservative recommendations on the fate of a billion-dollar mission. I could imagine, for example, a key instrument failure in Chrysi just after an unfortunate crash landing in Cydonia. To improve the Viking options, additional landing sites, geologically very different from Chrysi and Cydonia, were selected in the radar-certified region near 4 degrees south latitude. A decision on whether Viking 2 would set down at high or low latitude was not made until virtually the last minute, when a place with the hopeful name of Utopia, at the same latitude as Cydonia, was chosen. For Viking 1, the original landing site seemed, after we examined orbiter photographs and late-breaking Earth-based radar data, unacceptably risky. For a while, I worried that Viking 1 had been condemned, like the legendary Flying Dutchman, to wander the skies of Mars forever, never to find safe haven. Eventually, we found a suitable spot. Still in Chrysi, but far from the confluence of the four ancient channels. The delay prevented us from setting down on July 4, 1976, but it was generally agreed that a crash landing on that date would have been an unsatisfactory 200th birthday present for the United States. We de-boosted from orbit and entered the Martian atmosphere 16 days later. After an interplanetary voyage of a year and a half, covering 100 million kilometers the long way around the sun, each orbiter-lander combination was inserted into its proper orbit about Mars. The orbiters surveyed candidate landing sites. The landers entered the Martian atmosphere on radio command and correctly oriented ablation shields, deployed parachutes, divested coverings, and fired retro rockets. In Chrysi and Utopia, for the first time in human history, spacecraft had touched down gently and safely on the Red Planet. These triumphant landings were due in considerable part to the great skill invested in their design, fabrication, and testing, and to the abilities of the spacecraft controllers. But for so dangerous and mysterious a planet as Mars, there was also at least an element of luck. Immediately after landing, the first pictures were to be returned. We knew we had chosen dull places, but we could hope. The first picture, taken by the Viking 1 lander, was one of its own footpads. In case it were to sink into Martian quicksand, we wanted to know about it before the spacecraft disappeared. The picture built up line by line, until, with enormous relief, we saw the footpad sitting high and dry above the Martian surface. Soon, other pictures came into being. Each picture element radioed individually back to Earth. I remember being transfixed by the first lander image to show the horizon of Mars. This was not an alien world, I thought. I knew places like it in Colorado and Arizona and Nevada. There were rocks and sand drifts and a distant eminence as natural and unselfconscious as any landscape on Earth. Mars was a place. I would, of course, have been surprised to see a grizzled prospector emerge from behind a dune leading his mule, but at the same time, the idea seemed appropriate. Nothing remotely like it ever entered my mind in all the hours I spent examining the Venera 9 and 10 images of the Venus surface. One way or another, I knew this was a world to which we would return. The landscape is stark and red and lovely. Boulders thrown out in the creation of a crater somewhere over the horizon, small sand dunes, rocks that have been repeatedly covered and uncovered by drifting dust, plumes of fine-grained material blown about by the winds. Where did the rocks come from? How much sand had been blown by wind? What must the previous history of the planet have been to create sheared rocks, buried boulders, polygonal gouges in the ground? What are the rocks made of? The same materials as the sand? Is the sand merely pulverized rock or something else? Why is the sky pink? What is the air made of? How fast does the wind blow? Are there Mars quakes? How do the atmospheric pressure and the appearance of the landscape change with the seasons? For every one of these questions, Viking had provided definitive or at least plausible answers. The Mars revealed by the Viking mission is of enormous interest, particularly when we remember that the landing sites were chosen for their dullness. But the cameras revealed no sign of canal builders, no Barsoomian air cars or short swords, no princesses or fighting men, no throats, no footprints, not even a cactus or a kangaroo rat. For as far as we could see, there was not a sign of life. There was a brief flurry when the uppercase letter B, a putative Martian graffito, seemed to be visible on a small boulder in Chrysi. But later analysis showed it to be a trick of light and shadow, and the human talent for pattern recognition. It also seems remarkable that the Martians should have tumbled independently to the Latin alphabet, but there was just a moment when resounding in my head was the distant echo of a word from my boyhood. Barsoom. Perhaps there are large life forms on Mars, but not in our two landing sites. Perhaps there are smaller forms in every rock and sand grain. For most of its history, those regions of the Earth not covered by water looked rather like Mars today, with an atmosphere rich in carbon dioxide, with ultraviolet light shining fiercely down on the surface through an atmosphere devoid of ozone. Large plants and animals did not colonize the land until the last 10% of Earth history, and yet for 3 billion years, there were microorganisms everywhere on Earth. To look for life on Mars, we must look for microbes. The Viking lander extends human capabilities to other and alien landscapes. By some standards, it is about as smart as a grasshopper. By others, only as intelligent as a bacterium. There is nothing demeaning in these comparisons. It took nature hundreds of millions of years to evolve a bacterium, and billions to make a grasshopper. With only a little experience in this sort of business, we are becoming fairly skillful at it. Viking has two eyes, as we do, but they also work in the infrared, as ours do not. A sample arm that can push rocks, dig, and acquire soil samples, a kind of finger that it puts up to measure wind speed and direction, a nose, and taste buds, of a sort, with which it senses, to a much higher precision than we can, the presence of trace molecules, an interior ear, with which it can detect the rumbling of Mars quakes and the gentler, wind-driven jiggling of the spacecraft, and a means of detecting microbes. The spacecraft has its own self-contained radioactive power source. It radios all the scientific information it acquires back to Earth. It receives instructions from Earth so human beings can ponder the significance of the Viking results and tell the spacecraft to do something new. But what is the optimum way, given severe constraints on size, cost, and power requirements, to search for microbes on Mars? We cannot, at least yet, send microbiologists there. I once had a friend, an extraordinary microbiologist named Wolf Vishniak of the University of Rochester in New York. In the late 1950s, when we were just beginning to think seriously about looking for life on Mars, he found himself at a scientific meeting where an astronomer expressed amazement that the biologists had no simple, reliable, automated instrument capable of looking for microorganisms. Vishniak decided he would do something about the matter. He developed a small device to be sent to the planets. His friends called it the Wolf Trap. It would carry a little vial of nutrient organic matter to Mars, arrange for a sample of Martian soil to be mixed with it, and observe the changing turbidity or cloudiness of the liquid as the Martian bugs, if there were any, grew, if they would. The Wolf Trap was selected along with three other microbiology experiments to go aboard the Viking landers. Two of the other three experiments also chose to send food to the Martians. The success of the Wolf Trap required that Martian bugs like liquid water. There were those who thought that Vishniak would only drown the little Martians. But the advantage of the Wolf Trap was that it laid no requirements on what the Martian microbes must do with their food. They had only to grow. All the other experiments made specific assumptions about gases that would be given off or taken in by the microbes, assumptions that were little more than guesses. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration, which runs the United States Planetary Space Program, is subject to frequent and unpredictable budget cuts. Only rarely are there unanticipated budget increases. NASA scientific activities have very little effective support in the government, and so science is most often the target when money needs to be taken away from NASA. In 1971, it was decided that one of the four microbiology experiments must be removed, and the Wolf Trap was offloaded. It was a crushing disappointment for Vishniak, who had invested 12 years in its development. Many others in his place might have stalked off the Viking biology team, but Vishniak was a gentle and dedicated man. He decided instead that he could best serve the search for life on Mars by voyaging to the most Mars-like environment on Earth, the dry valleys of Antarctica. Some previous investigators had examined Antarctic soil and decided that the few microbes they were able to find were not really natives of the dry valleys, but had been blown there from other, more clement environments. Recalling the Mars Jars experiments, Vishniak believed that life was tenacious and that Antarctica was perfectly consistent with microbiology. If terrestrial bugs could live on Mars, he thought, why not in Antarctica, which was, by and large, warmer, wetter, and had more oxygen and much less ultraviolet light? Conversely, finding life in Antarctic dry valleys would correspondingly improve, he thought, the chances of life on Mars. Vishniak believed that the experimental techniques previously used to deduce no indigenous microbes in Antarctica were flawed. The nutrients, while suitable for the comfortable environment of a university microbiology laboratory, were not designed for the arid polar wasteland. So, on November 8, 1973, Vishniak, his new microbiology equipment, and a geologist companion were transported by helicopter from McMurdo Station to an area near Mount Balder, a dry valley in the Asgard Range. His practice was to implant the little microbiology stations in the Antarctic soil and return about a month later to retrieve them. On December 10, 1973, he left to gather samples on Mount Balder. His departure was photographed from about 3 kilometers away. It was the last time anyone saw him alive. 18 hours later, his body was discovered at the base of a cliff of ice. He had wandered into an area not previously explored, had apparently slipped on the ice and tumbled and bounced for a distance of 150 meters. Perhaps something had caught his eye, a likely habitat for microbes, say, or a patch of green where none should be. We will never know. In the small brown notebook he was carrying that day, the last entry reads, "Station 202 retrieved. 10 December 1973, 2230 hours. Soil temperature, minus 10 degrees. Air temperature, minus 16 degrees. It had been a typical summer temperature for Mars. Many of Vishniak's microbiology stations are still sitting in Antarctica, but the samples that were returned were examined using his methods by his professional colleagues and friends. A wide variety of microbes, which would have been indetectable with conventional scoring techniques, was found in essentially every site examined. A new species of yeast, apparently unique to Antarctica, was discovered in his samples by his widow, Helen Simpson Vishniak. Large rocks returned from Antarctica in that expedition, examined by Imre Friedman, turned out to have fascinating microbiology. 1 or 2 millimeters inside the rock, algae have colonized a tiny world in which small quantities of water are trapped and made liquid. On Mars, such a place would be even more interesting, because while the visible light necessary for photosynthesis would penetrate to that depth, the germicidal ultraviolet light would be at least partially attenuated. Because the design of space missions is finalized many years before launch, and because of Vishniak's death, the results of his Antarctic experiments did not influence the Viking design for seeking Martian life. In general, the microbiology experiments were not carried out at the low ambient Martian temperatures, and most did not provide long incubation times. They all made fairly strong assumptions about what Martian metabolism had to be like. There was no way to look for life inside the rocks. Each Viking lander was equipped with a sample arm to acquire material from the surface and then slowly withdraw it into the innards of the spacecraft, transporting the particles on little hoppers, like an electric train, to 5 different experiments. One on the inorganic chemistry of the soil, another to look for organic molecules in the sand and dust, and 3 to look for microbial life. When we look for life on a planet, we are making certain assumptions. We try, as well as we can, not to assume that life elsewhere will be just like life here, but there are limits to what we can do. We know in detail only about life here. While the Viking biology experiments are a pioneering first effort, they hardly represent a definitive search for life on Mars. The results have been tantalizing, annoying, provocative, stimulating, and, at least until recently, substantially inconclusive. Each of the three microbiology experiments asked a different kind of question, but in all cases, a question about Martian metabolism. If there are microorganisms in the Martian soil, they must take in food and give off waste gases, or they must take in gases from the atmosphere and perhaps, with the aid of sunlight, convert them into useful materials. So, we bring food to Mars and hope that the Martians, if there are any, will find it tasty. Then we see if any interesting new gases come out of the soil. Or we provide our own radioactively labeled gases and see if they are converted into organic matter, in which case small Martians are inferred. By criteria established before launch, two of the three Viking microbiology experiments seem to have yielded positive results. First, when Martian soil was mixed with a sterile organic soup from Earth, something in the soil chemically broke down the soup, almost as if there were respiring microbes metabolizing a food package from Earth. Second, when gases from Earth were introduced into the Martian soil sample, the gases became chemically combined with the soil, almost as if there were photosynthesizing microbes generating organic matter from atmospheric gases. Positive results in Martian microbiology were achieved in 7 different samplings in 2 locales on Mars, separated by 5,000 kilometers. But the situation is complex, and the criteria of experimental success may have been inadequate. Enormous efforts were made to build the Viking microbiology experiments and test them with a variety of microbes. Very little effort was made to calibrate the experiments with plausible inorganic Martian surface materials. Mars is not the Earth. As the legacy of Percival Lowell reminds us, we can be fooled. Perhaps there is an exotic inorganic chemistry in the Martian soil that is able, by itself, in the absence of Martian microbes, to oxidize foodstuffs. Perhaps there is some special inorganic, non-living catalyst in the soil that is able to fix atmospheric gases and convert them into organic molecules. Recent experiments suggest that this may indeed be the case. In the Great Martian Dust Storm of 1971, spectral features of the dust were obtained by the Mariner 9 infrared spectrometer. In analyzing these spectra, O.B. Toon, J.B. Pollock, and I found that certain features seem best accounted for by montmorillonite and other kinds of clay. Subsequent observations by the Viking lander support the identification of windblown clays on Mars. Now, A. Bannon and J. Rishpan have found that they can reproduce some of the key features, those resembling photosynthesis as well as those resembling respiration, of the successful Viking microbiology experiments if, in laboratory experiments, they substitute such clays for the Martian soil. The clays have a complex active surface given to absorbing and releasing gases and to catalyzing chemical reactions. It is too soon to say that all the Viking microbiology results can be explained by inorganic chemistry, but such a result would no longer be surprising. The clay hypothesis hardly excludes life on Mars, but it certainly carries us far enough to say that there is no compelling evidence for microbiology on Mars. Even so, the results of Bannon and Rishpan are of great biological importance because they show that in the absence of life, there can be a kind of soil chemistry that does some of the same things life does. On the Earth, before life, there may already have been chemical processes resembling respiration and photosynthesis cycling in the soil, perhaps to be incorporated by life once it arose. In addition, we know that montmorillonite clays are a potent catalyst for combining amino acids into longer chain molecules resembling proteins. The clays of the primitive Earth may have been the forge of life, and the chemistry of contemporary Mars may provide essential clues to the origin and early history of life on our planet. The Martian surface exhibits many impact craters, each named after a person, usually a scientist. Crater Vishniac lies appropriately in the Antarctic region of Mars. Vishniac did not claim that there had to be life on Mars, merely that it was possible and that it was extraordinarily important to know if it was there. If life on Mars exists, we will have a unique opportunity to test the generality of our kind of life. And if there is no life on Mars, a planet rather like Earth, we must understand why. Because in that case, as Vishniac stressed, we have the classic scientific confrontation of the experiment and the control. The finding that the Viking microbiology results can be explained by clays, that they need not imply life, helps to resolve another mystery. The Viking organic chemistry experiment showed not a hint of organic matter in the Martian soil. If there is life on Mars, where are the dead bodies? No organic molecules could be found, no building blocks of proteins and nucleic acids, no simple hydrocarbons, nothing of the stuff of life on Earth. This is not necessarily a contradiction, because the Viking microbiology experiments are 1,000 times more sensitive per equivalent carbon atom than the Viking chemistry experiments and seem to detect organic matter synthesized in the Martian soil. But this does not leave much margin. Terrestrial soil is loaded with the organic remains of once living organisms. Martian soil has less organic matter than the surface of the moon. If we held to the life hypothesis, we might suppose that the dead bodies have been destroyed by the chemically reactive oxidizing surface of Mars, like a germ in a bottle of hydrogen peroxide, or that there is life, but of a kind in which organic chemistry plays a less central role than it does in life on Earth. But this last alternative seems to me to be special pleading. I am, reluctantly, a self-confessed carbon chauvinist. Carbon is abundant in the cosmos. It makes marvelously complex molecules good for life. I am also a water chauvinist. Water makes an ideal solvent system for organic chemistry to work in and stays liquid over a wide range of temperatures. But sometimes, I wonder, could my fondness for materials have something to do with the fact that I am made chiefly of them? Are we carbon and water-based because those materials were abundant on the Earth at the time of the origin of life? Could life elsewhere, on Mars, say, be built of different stuff? I am a collection of water, calcium, and organic molecules called Carl Sagan. You are a collection of almost identical molecules with a different collective label. But is that all? Is there nothing in here but molecules? Some people find this idea somehow demeaning to human dignity. For myself, I find it elevating that our universe permits the evolution of molecular machines as intricate and subtle as we. But the essence of life is not so much the atoms and simple molecules that make us up as the way in which they are put together. Every now and then, we read that the chemicals which constitute the human body cost 97 cents or $10 or some such figure. It is a little depressing to find our bodies valued so little. However, these estimates are for human beings reduced to our simplest possible components. We are made mostly of water, which costs almost nothing. The carbon is costed in the form of coal, the calcium in our bones as chalk, the nitrogen in our proteins as air, cheap also. The iron in our blood is rusty nails. If we did not know better, we might be tempted to take all the atoms that make us up, mix them together in a big container, and stir. We can do this as much as we want, but in the end, all we have is a tedious mixture of atoms. How could we have expected anything else? Harold Morowitz has calculated what it would cost to put together the correct molecular constituents that make up a human being by buying the molecules from chemical supply houses. The answer turns out to be about $10 million, which should make us all feel a little better. But even then, we could not mix those chemicals together and have a human being emerge from the jar. That is far beyond our capability and will probably be so for a very long period of time. Fortunately, there are other, less expensive, but still highly reliable methods of making human beings. I think the life forms on many worlds will consist, by and large, of the same atoms we have here. Perhaps even many of the same basic molecules, such as proteins and nucleic acids, but put together in unfamiliar ways. Perhaps organisms that float in dense planetary atmospheres will be very much like us in their atomic composition, except they might not have bones and therefore not need much calcium. Perhaps elsewhere, some solvent other than water is used. Hydrofluoric acid might serve rather well, although there is not a great deal of fluorine in the cosmos. Hydrofluoric acid would do a great deal of damage to the kind of molecules that make us up, but other organic molecules, paraffin waxes, for example, are perfectly stable in its presence. Liquid ammonia would make an even better solvent system, because ammonia is very abundant in the cosmos. But it is liquid only on worlds much colder than the Earth or Mars. Ammonia is ordinarily a gas on Earth, as water is on Venus. Or perhaps there are living things that do not have a solvent system at all. Solid-state life, where there are electrical signals propagating rather than molecules floating about. But these ideas do not rescue the notion that the Viking lander experiments indicate life on Mars. On that rather Earth-like world with abundant carbon and water, life, if it exists, should be based on organic chemistry. The organic chemistry results, like the imaging and microbiology results, are all consistent with no life in the fine particles of Crisi and Utopia in the late 1970s. Perhaps some millimeters beneath the rocks, as in the Antarctic dry valleys or elsewhere on the planet, or in some earlier, more clement time, but not where and when we looked. The Viking exploration of Mars is a mission of major historical importance, the first serious search for what other kinds of life may be, the first survival of a functioning spacecraft for more than an hour or so on any other planet. Viking 1 has survived for years. The source of a rich harvest of data on the geology, seismology, mineralogy, meteorology, and half a dozen other sciences of another world. How should we follow up on these spectacular advances? Some scientists want to send an automatic device that would land, acquire soil samples, and return them to Earth where they could be examined in great detail in the large, sophisticated laboratories of Earth rather than in the limited, micro-miniaturized laboratories that we were able to send to Mars. In this way, most of the ambiguities of the Viking microbiology experiments could be resolved. The chemistry and mineralogy of the soil could be determined. Rocks could be broken open to search for subsurface life. Hundreds of tests for organic chemistry and life could be performed, including direct microscopic examination under a wide range of conditions. We could even use Vishniak's scoring techniques. Although it would be fairly expensive, such a mission is probably within our technological capability. However, it carries with it a novel danger: back contamination. If we wish on Earth to examine samples of Martian soil for microbes, we must, of course, not sterilize the samples beforehand. The point of the expedition is to bring them back alive, but what then? Might Martian microorganisms returned to Earth pose a public health hazard? The Martians of H.G. Wells and Orson Welles, preoccupied with the suppression of Bournemouth and Jersey City, never noticed until too late that their immunological defenses were unavailing against the microbes of Earth. Is the converse possible? This is a serious and difficult issue. There may be no micro-Martians. If they exist, perhaps we can eat a kilogram of them with no ill effects, but we are not sure, and the stakes are high. If we wish to return unsterilized Martian samples to Earth, we must have a containment procedure that is stupefyingly reliable. There are nations that develop and stockpile bacteriological weapons. They seem to have an occasional accident, but they have not yet, so far as I know, produced global pandemics. Perhaps Martian samples can be safely returned to Earth. But I would want to be very sure before considering a returned sample mission. There is another way to investigate Mars and the full range of delights and discoveries this heterogeneous planet holds for us. My most persistent emotion in working with the Viking lander pictures was frustration at our immobility. I found myself unconsciously urging the spacecraft at least to stand on its tiptoes, as if this laboratory, designed for immobility, were perversely refusing to manage even a little hop. How we longed to poke that dune with the sample arm, look for life beneath that rock, see if that distant ridge was a crater rampart. And not so very far to the southeast, I knew, were the four sinuous channels of Chrysi. For all the tantalizing and provocative character of the Viking results, I know 100 places on Mars which are far more interesting than our landing sites. The ideal tool is a roving vehicle carrying on advanced experiments, particularly in imaging, chemistry, and biology. Prototypes of such rovers are under development by NASA. They know on their own how to go over rocks, how not to fall down ravines, how to get out of tight spots. It is within our capability to land a rover on Mars that could scan its surroundings, see the most interesting place in its field of view, and, by the same time tomorrow, be there. Every day, a new place, a complex, winding traverse over the varied topography of this appealing planet. Such a mission would reap enormous scientific benefits, even if there is no life on Mars. We could wander down the ancient river valleys, up the slopes of one of the great volcanic mountains, along the strange stepped terrain of the icy polar terraces, or muster a close approach to the beckoning pyramids of Mars. The largest are 3 kilometers across at the base and 1 kilometer high, much larger than the pyramids of Sumer, Egypt, or Mexico on Earth. They seem eroded and ancient and are perhaps only small mountains, sandblasted for ages. But they warrant, I think, a careful look. Public interest in such a mission would be sizable. Every day, a new set of vistas would arrive on our home television screens. We could trace the route, ponder the findings, suggest new destinations. The journey would be long. The rover, obedient to radio commands from Earth, there would be plenty of time for good new ideas to be incorporated into the mission plan. 1 billion people could participate in the exploration of another world. The surface area of Mars is exactly as large as the land area of the Earth. A thorough reconnaissance will clearly occupy us for centuries, but there will be a time when Mars is all explored. A time after robot aircraft have mapped it from aloft. A time after rovers have combed the surface. A time after samples have been returned safely to Earth. A time after human beings have walked the sands of Mars. What then? What shall we do with Mars? There are so many examples of human misuse of the Earth that even phrasing this question chills me. If there is life on Mars, I believe we should do nothing with Mars. Mars then belongs to the Martians, even if the Martians are only microbes. The existence of an independent biology on a nearby planet is a treasure beyond assessing, and the preservation of that life must, I think, supersede any other possible use of Mars. However, suppose Mars is lifeless. It is not a plausible source of raw materials. The freightage from Mars to Earth would be too expensive for many centuries to come. But might we be able to live on Mars? Could we in some sense make Mars habitable? A lovely world, surely, but there is, from our parochial point of view, much wrong with Mars, chiefly the low oxygen abundance, the absence of liquid water, and the high ultraviolet flux. The low temperatures do not pose an insuperable obstacle, as the year-round scientific stations in Antarctica demonstrate. All of these problems could be solved if we could make more air. With higher atmospheric pressures, liquid water would be possible. With more oxygen, we might breathe the atmosphere, and ozone would form to shield the surface from solar ultraviolet radiation. The sinuous channels, stacked polar plates, and other evidence suggest that Mars once had such a denser atmosphere. Those gases are unlikely to have escaped from Mars. They are, therefore, on the planet somewhere. Some are chemically combined with the surface rocks. Some are in subsurface ice, but most may be in the present polar ice caps. To vaporize the caps, we must heat them. Perhaps we could dust them with a dark powder, heating them by absorbing more sunlight, the opposite of what we do to the Earth when we destroy forests and grasslands. But the surface area of the caps is very large. The necessary dust would require 1,200 Saturn V rocket boosters to be transported from Earth to Mars. Even then, the winds might blow the dust off the polar caps. A better way would be to devise some dark material able to make copies of itself, a little dusky machine which we deliver to Mars and which then goes about reproducing itself from indigenous materials all over the polar caps. There is a category of such machines. We call them plants. Some are very hardy and resilient. We know that at least some terrestrial microbes can survive on Mars. What is necessary is a program of artificial selection and genetic engineering of dark plants, perhaps lichens, that could survive the much more severe Martian environment. If such plants could be bred, we might imagine them being seeded on the vast expanse of the Martian polar ice caps, taking root, spreading, blackening the ice caps, absorbing sunlight, heating the ice, and releasing the ancient Martian atmosphere from its long captivity. We might even imagine a kind of Martian Johnny Appleseed, robot or human, roaming the frozen polar wastes in an endeavor that benefits only the generations of humans to come. This general concept is called terraforming, the changing of an alien landscape into one more suitable for human beings. In thousands of years, humans have managed to perturb the global temperature of the Earth by only about 1 degree through greenhouse and albedo changes, although at the present rate of burning fossil fuels and destroying forests and grasslands, we can now change the global temperature by another degree in only a century or two. These and other considerations suggest that a timescale for a significant terraforming of Mars is probably hundreds to thousands of years. In a future time of greatly advanced technology, we might wish not only to increase the total atmospheric pressure and make liquid water possible, but also to carry liquid water from the melting polar caps to the warmer equatorial regions. There is, of course, a way to do it. We would build canals. The melting surface and subsurface ice would be transported by a great canal network. But this is precisely what Percival Lowell, not 100 years ago, mistakenly proposed was in fact happening on Mars. Lowell and Wallace both understood that the comparative inhospitability of Mars was due to the scarcity of water. If only a network of canals existed, the lack would be remedied. The habitability of Mars would become plausible. Lowell's observations were made under extremely difficult seeing conditions. Others, like Schiaparelli, had already observed something like the canals. They were called the canali before Lowell began his lifelong love affair with Mars. Human beings have a demonstrated talent for self-deception when their emotions are stirred, and there are few notions more stirring than the idea of a neighboring planet inhabited by intelligent beings. The power of Lowell's idea may just possibly make it a kind of premonition. His canal network was built by Martians. Even this may be an accurate prophecy. If the planet ever is terraformed, it will be done by human beings whose permanent residence and planetary affiliation is Mars. The Martians will be us. Chapter 6, Traveler's Tales. Do there exist many worlds, or is there but a single world? This is one of the most noble and exalted questions in the study of nature. Albertus Magnus, 13th century. We may mount from this dull earth and, viewing it from on high, consider whether nature has laid out all her cost and finery upon this small speck of dirt. So, like travelers, into other distant countries, we shall be better able to judge of what's done at home, know how to make a true estimate of and set its own value upon everything. We shall be less apt to admire what this world calls great, shall nobly despise those trifles the generality of men set their affections on, when we know that there are a multitude of such earths inhabited and adorned, as well as our own. Christian Huygens, The Celestial Worlds Discovered, circa 1690. This is the time when humans have begun to sail the sea of space. The modern ships that ply the Keplerian trajectories to the planets are unmanned. They are beautifully constructed, semi-intelligent robots exploring unknown worlds. Voyages to the outer solar system are controlled from a single place on the planet Earth, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration in Pasadena, California. On July 9, 1979, a spacecraft called Voyager 2 encountered the Jupiter system. It had been almost 2 years sailing through interplanetary space. The ship is made of millions of separate parts, assembled redundantly, so that if some component fails, others will take over its responsibilities. The spacecraft weighs 0.9 tons and would fill a large living room. Its mission takes it so far from the sun that it cannot be powered by solar energy, as other spacecraft are. Instead, Voyager relies on a small nuclear power plant, drawing hundreds of watts from the radioactive decay of a pellet of plutonium. Its three integrated computers and most of its housekeeping functions, for example, its temperature-controlled system, are localized in its middle. It receives commands from Earth and radios its findings back to Earth through a large antenna, 3.7 meters in diameter. Most of its scientific instruments are on a scan platform, which tracks Jupiter or one of its moons as the spacecraft hurtles past. There are many scientific instruments, ultraviolet and infrared spectrometers, devices to measure charged particles and magnetic fields, and the radio emission from Jupiter. But the most productive have been the two television cameras, designed to take tens of thousands of pictures of the planetary islands in the outer solar system. Jupiter is surrounded by a shell of invisible but extremely dangerous high-energy charged particles. The spacecraft must pass through the outer edge of this radiation belt to examine Jupiter and its moons close up and to continue its mission to Saturn and beyond. But the charged particles can damage the delicate instruments and fry the electronics. Jupiter is also surrounded by a ring of solid debris discovered 4 months earlier by Voyager 1, which Voyager 2 had to traverse. A collision with a small boulder could have sent the spacecraft tumbling wildly out of control, its antenna unable to lock on the Earth, its data lost forever. Just before the encounter, the mission controllers were restive. There were some alarms and emergencies, but the combined intelligence of the humans on Earth and the robot in space circumvented disaster. Launched on August 20th, 1977, it moved on an arcing trajectory past the orbit of Mars through the asteroid belt to approach the Jupiter system and thread its way past the planet and among its 14 or so moons. Voyager's passage by Jupiter accelerated it toward a close encounter with Saturn. Saturn's gravity will propel it on to Uranus. After Uranus, it will plunge on past Neptune, leaving the solar system, becoming an interstellar spacecraft, fated to roam forever the great ocean between the stars. These voyages of exploration and discovery are the latest in a long series that have characterized and distinguished human history. In the 15th and 16th centuries, you could travel from Spain to the Azores in a few days, the same time it takes us now to cross the channel from the Earth to the Moon. It took then a few months to traverse the Atlantic Ocean and reach what was called the New World, the Americas. Today, it takes a few months to cross the ocean of the inner solar system and make planetfall on Mars or Venus, which are truly and literally new worlds awaiting us. In the 17th and 18th centuries, you could travel from Holland to China in a year or two, the time it has taken Voyager to travel from Earth to Jupiter. The annual costs were relatively more then than now, but in both cases, less than 1% of the appropriate gross national product. Our present spaceships, with their robot crews, are the harbingers, the vanguards of future human expeditions to the planets. We have traveled this way before. The 15th through 17th centuries represent a major turning point in our history. It then became clear that we could venture to all parts of our planet. Plucky sailing vessels from half a dozen European nations dispersed to every ocean. There were many motivations for these journeys: ambition, greed, national pride, religious fanaticism, prison pardons, scientific curiosity, the thirst for adventure, and the unavailability of suitable employment in Estremadura. These voyages worked much evil as well as much good, but the net result has been to bind the Earth together, to decrease provincialism, to unify the human species, and to advance powerfully our knowledge of our planet and ourselves. Emblematic of the epoch of sailing ship exploration and discovery is the revolutionary Dutch Republic of the 17th century. Having recently declared its independence from the powerful Spanish Empire, it embraced more fully than any other nation of its time the European Enlightenment. It was a rational, orderly, creative society. But because Spanish ports and vessels were closed to Dutch shipping, the economic survival of the tiny republic depended on its ability to construct, man, and deploy a great fleet of commercial sailing vessels. The Dutch East India Company, a joint governmental and private enterprise, sent ships to the far corners of the world to acquire rare commodities and resell them at a profit in Europe. Such voyages were the lifeblood of the Republic. Navigational charts and maps were classified as state secrets. Ships often embarked with sealed orders. Suddenly, the Dutch were present all over the planet. The Barents Sea in the Arctic Ocean and Tasmania in Australia are named after Dutch sea captains. These expeditions were not merely commercial exploitations, although there was plenty of that. There were powerful elements of scientific adventure and the zest for discovery of new lands, new plants and animals, new people, the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake. The Amsterdam Town Hall reflects the confident and secular self-image of 17th century Holland. It took shiploads of marble to build. Constantine Huygens, a poet and diplomat of the time, remarked that the town hall dispelled the Gothic squint and squalor. In the town hall to this day, there is a statue of Atlas supporting the heavens, festooned with constellations. Beneath is Justice, brandishing a golden sword and scales, standing between death and punishment, and treading underfoot avarice and envy, the gods of the merchants. The Dutch, whose economy was based on private profit, nevertheless understood that the unrestrained pursuit of profit posed a threat to the nation's soul. A less allegorical symbol may be found under Atlas and Justice on the floor of the town hall. It is a great inlaid map, dating from the late 17th or early 18th centuries, reaching from West Africa to the Pacific Ocean. The whole world was Holland's arena, and on this map, with disarming modesty, the Dutch omitted themselves, using only the old Latin name, Belgium, for their part of Europe. In a typical year, many ships set sail halfway around the world, down the west coast of Africa through what they called the Ethiopian Sea, around the south coast of Africa, within the Straits of Madagascar, and on past the southern tip of India, they sailed to one major focus of their interests, the Spice Islands, present-day Indonesia. Some expeditions journeyed from there to a land named New Holland, and today called Australia. A few ventured through the Straits of Malacca past the Philippines to China. We know, from a mid-17th century account, of an embassy from the East India Company of the United Provinces of the Netherlands to the Grand Tartar, Cham, Emperor of China. The Dutch burghers, ambassadors, and sea captains stood wide-eyed in amazement, face to face with another civilization in the imperial city of Peking. We even know what gifts they brought the court. The empress was presented with 6 little chests of divers' pictures, and the emperor received 2 fardels of cinnamon. Never before or since has Holland been the world power it was then. A small country forced to live by its wits, its foreign policy contained a strong pacifist element. Because of its tolerance for unorthodox opinions, it was a haven for intellectuals who were refugees from censorship and thought control elsewhere in Europe, much as the United States benefited enormously in the 1930s by the exodus of intellectuals from the Nazi-dominated Europe. So 17th century Holland was the home of the great Jewish philosopher Spinoza, whom Einstein admired, of Descartes, a pivotal figure in the history of mathematics and philosophy, and of John Locke, a political scientist who influenced a group of philosophically inclined revolutionaries named Paine, Hamilton, Adams, Franklin, and Jefferson. Never before or since has Holland been graced by such a galaxy of artists and scientists, philosophers, and mathematicians. This was the time of the master painters Rembrandt and Vermeer, and Frans Hals, of Leeuwenhoek, the inventor of the microscope, of Grotius, the founder of international law, of Willibrord Snellius, who discovered the law of the refraction of light. In the Dutch tradition of encouraging freedom of thought, the University of Leiden offered a professorship to an Italian scientist named Galileo, who had been forced by the Catholic Church under threat of torture to recant his heretical view that the earth moved about the sun and not vice versa. Galileo had close ties with Holland, and his first astronomical telescope was an improvement of a spyglass of Dutch design. With it, he discovered sunspots, the phases of Venus, the craters of the moon, and the 4 large moons of Jupiter now called after him, the Galilean satellites. Galileo's own description of his ecclesiastical travails is contained in a letter he wrote in the year 1615 to the Grand Duchess Christina. Some years ago, as your Serene Highness well knows, I discovered in the heavens many things that had not been seen before our own age. The novelty of these things, as well as some consequences which followed from them in contradiction to the physical notions commonly held among academic philosophers, stirred up against me no small number of professors, many of them ecclesiastics, as if I had placed these things in the sky with my own hands in order to upset nature and overturn the sciences. They seem to forget that the increase of known truths stimulates the investigation, establishment, and growth of the arts. The courage of Galileo and Kepler in promoting the heliocentric hypothesis was not evident in the actions of others, even those residing in less fanatically doctrinal parts of Europe. For example, in a letter dated April 1634, René Descartes, then living in Holland, wrote, "Doubtless you know that Galileo was recently censured by the inquisitors of the faith, and that his views about the movement of the earth were condemned as heretical. I must tell you that all the things I explained in my treatise, which included the doctrine of the movement of the earth, were so interdependent that it is enough to discover that one of them is false to know that all the arguments I was using are unsound. Though I thought they were based on very certain and evident proofs, I would not wish for anything in the world to maintain them against the authority of the Church. I desire to live in peace and to continue the life I have begun under the motto, 'To live well, you must live unseen.'" The connection between Holland as an exploratory power and Holland as an intellectual and cultural center was very strong. The improvement of sailing ships encouraged technology of all kinds. People enjoyed working with their hands, inventions were prized. Technological advance required the freest possible pursuit of knowledge, so Holland became the leading publisher and bookseller in Europe, translating works written in other languages and permitting the publication of works prescribed elsewhere. Adventures into exotic lands and encounters with strange societies shook complacency, challenged thinkers to reconsider the prevailing wisdom, and showed that ideas that had been accepted for thousands of years, for example, on geography, were fundamentally in error. In a time when kings and emperors ruled much of the world, the Dutch Republic was governed more than any other nation by the people. The openness of the society and its encouragement of the life of the mind, its material well-being, and its commitment to the exploration and utilization of new worlds generated a joyful confidence in the human enterprise. This exploratory tradition may account for the fact that Holland has, to this day, produced far more than its per capita share of distinguished astronomers, among them Gerard Peter Kuiper, who, in the 1940s and 1950s, was the world's only full-time planetary astrophysicist. The subject was then considered by most professional astronomers to be at least slightly disreputable, tainted with Lowellian excesses. I am grateful to have been Kuiper's student. In Italy, Galileo had announced other worlds, and Giordano Bruno had speculated on other life forms. For this, they had been made to suffer brutally. But in Holland, the astronomer Christian Huygens, who believed in both, was showered with honors. His father was Constantijn Huygens, a master diplomat of the age, a litterateur, poet, composer, musician, close friend and translator of the English poet John Donne, and the head of an archetypical great family. Constantijn admired the painter Rubens and discovered a young artist named Rembrandt van Rijn, in several of whose works he subsequently appears. After their first meeting, Descartes wrote of him, "I could not believe that a single mind could occupy itself with so many things and equip itself so well in all of them." The Huygens home was filled with goods from all over the world. Distinguished thinkers from other nations were frequent guests. Growing up in this environment, the young Christian Huygens became simultaneously adept in languages, drawing, law, science, engineering, mathematics, and music. His interests and allegiances were broad. "The world is my country," he said, "science, my religion." Light was a motif of the age, the symbolic enlightenment of freedom of thought and religion, of geographical discovery, the light that permeated the paintings of the time, particularly the exquisite work of Vermeer, and light as an object of scientific inquiry, as in Schnell's study of refraction, Leeuwenhoek's invention of the microscope, and Huygens' own wave theory of light. These were all connected activities, and their practitioners mingled freely. Vermeer's interiors are characteristically filled with nautical artifacts and wall maps. Microscopes were drawing room curiosities. Leeuwenhoek was the executor of Vermeer's estate and a frequent visitor at the Huygens home in Hofwijk. Leeuwenhoek's microscope evolved from the magnifying glasses employed by drapers to examine the quality of cloth. With it, he discovered a universe in a drop of water. The microbes, which he described as animalcules, and thought cute. Huygens had contributed to the design of the first microscopes and himself made many discoveries with them. Leeuwenhoek and Huygens were among the first people ever to see human sperm cells, a prerequisite for understanding human reproduction. To explain how microorganisms slowly develop in water previously sterilized by boiling, Huygens proposed that they were small enough to float through the air and reproduced on alighting in water. Thus, he established an alternative to spontaneous generation, the notion that life could arise in fermenting grape juice or rotting meat entirely independent of pre-existing life. It was not until the time of Louis Pasteur, two centuries later, that Huygens' speculation was proved correct. The Viking search for life on Mars can be traced in more ways than one back to Leeuwenhoek and Huygens. They are also the grandfathers of the germ theory of disease, and therefore of much of modern medicine. But they had no practical motives in mind. They were merely tinkering in a technological society. The microscope and telescope, both developed in early 17th century Holland, represent an extension of human vision to the realms of the very small and the very large. Our observations of atoms and galaxies were launched in this time and place. Christian Huygens loved to grind and polish lenses for astronomical telescopes and constructed one 5 meters long. His discoveries with the telescope would by themselves have ensured his place in the history of human accomplishment. In the footsteps of Eratosthenes, he was the first person to measure the size of another planet. He was also the first to speculate that Venus is completely covered with clouds, the first to draw a surface feature on the planet Mars, a vast, dark, windswept slope called Syrtis Major, and by observing the appearance and disappearance of such features as the planet rotated, the first to determine that the Martian day was, like ours, roughly 24 hours long. He was the first to recognize that Saturn was surrounded by a system of rings which nowhere touches the planet. And he was the discoverer of Titan, the largest moon of Saturn, and, as we now know, the largest moon in the solar system, a world of extraordinary interest and promise. Most of these discoveries he made in his 20s. He also thought astrology was nonsense. Huygens did much more. A key problem for marine navigation in this age was the determination of a longitude. Latitude could easily be determined by the stars. The further south you were, the more southern constellations you could see. But longitude required precise timekeeping. An accurate shipboard clock would tell the time in your home port. The rising and setting of the sun and stars would specify the local shipboard time, and the difference between the two would yield your longitude. Huygens invented the pendulum clock. Its principle had been discovered earlier by Galileo, which was then employed, although not fully successfully, to calculate position in the midst of the great ocean. His efforts introduced an unprecedented accuracy in astronomical and other nautical clocks. He invented the spiral balance spring, still used in some watches today, made fundamental contributions to mechanics, for example, the calculation of centrifugal force, and from a study of the game of dice to the theory of probability. He improved the air pump, which was later to revolutionize the mining industry, and the magic lantern, the ancestor of the slide projector. He also invented something called the gunpowder engine, which influenced the development of another machine, the steam engine. Huygens was delighted that the Copernican view of the Earth as a planet in motion around the sun was widely accepted even by the ordinary people in Holland. Indeed, he said, Copernicus was acknowledged by all astronomers except those who were a bit slow-witted or under the superstitions imposed by merely human authority. In the Middle Ages, Christian philosophers were fond of arguing that since the heavens circle the earth once every day, they can hardly be infinite in extent, and therefore an infinite number of worlds, or even a large number of them, or even one other of them, is impossible. The discovery that the earth is turning rather than the sky moving had important implications for the uniqueness of the earth and the possibility of life elsewhere. Copernicus held that not just the solar system, but the entire universe was heliocentric, and Kepler denied that the stars have planetary systems. The first person to make explicit the idea of a large, indeed an infinite, number of other worlds in orbit about other suns seems to have been Giordano Bruno. But others thought that the plurality of worlds followed immediately from the ideas of Copernicus and Kepler and found themselves aghast. In the early 17th century, Robert Merton contended that the heliocentric hypothesis implied a multitude of other planetary systems, and that this was an argument of the sort called reductio ad absurdum, demonstrating the error of the initial assumption. He wrote in an argument which may once have seemed withering, For if the firmament be of such incomparable bigness as these Copernical giants will have it, so vast and full of innumerable stars, as being infinite in extent, why may we not suppose those infinite stars visible in the firmament to be so many suns with particular fixed centers to have likewise their subordinate planets, as the sun hath his, dancing still around him? And so, in consequence, there are infinite habitable worlds. What hinders? These and such like insolent and bold attempts, prodigious paradoxes, inferences, must needs follow, if it once be granted, which Kepler and others maintain of the earth's motion. But the earth does move. Merton, if he lived today, would be obliged to deduce infinite habitable worlds. Huygens did not shrink from this conclusion. He embraced it gladly. Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. By analogy with our solar system, Huygens reasoned that those stars should have their own planetary systems and that many of these planets might be inhabited. Should we allow the planets nothing but vast deserts and deprive them of all those creatures that more plainly bespeak their divine architect, we should sink them below the earth in beauty and dignity, a thing very unreasonable. A few others had held similar opinions. In his Harmonici Mundi, Kepler remarked it was Tycho Brahe's opinion concerning that bare wilderness of globes that it does not exist fruitlessly, but is filled with inhabitants. These ideas were set forth in an extraordinary book bearing the triumphant title The Celestial Worlds Discovered, Conjectures Concerning the Inhabitants, Plants, and Productions of the Worlds in the Planets. Composed shortly before Huygens died in 1690, the work was admired by many, including Tsar Peter the Great, who made it the first product of Western science to be published in Russia. The book is in large part about the nature or environments of the planets. Among the figures in the finely rendered first edition is one in which we see to scale the Sun and the giant planets Jupiter and Saturn. They are comparatively rather small. There is also an etching of Saturn next to the Earth. Our planet is a tiny circle. By and large, Huygens imagined the environments and inhabitants of other planets to be rather like those of 17th century Earth. He conceived of planetarians whose whole bodies, and every part of them, may be quite distinct and different from ours. 'Tis a very ridiculous opinion that it is impossible a rational soul should dwell in any other shape than ours. You could be smart, he was saying, even if you looked peculiar. But he then went on to argue that they would not look very peculiar, that they must have hands and feet and walk upright, that they would have writing and geometry, and that Jupiter has its four Galilean satellites to provide a navigational aid for the sailors in the Jovian oceans. Huygens was, of course, a citizen of his time. Who of us is not? He claimed science as his religion and then argued that the planets must be inhabited because otherwise God had made worlds for nothing. Because he lived before Darwin, his speculations about extraterrestrial life are innocent of the evolutionary perspective. But he was able to develop on observational grounds something akin to the modern cosmic perspective. What a wonderful and amazing scheme we have here on the magnificent vastness of the universe. So many suns, so many earths, and every one of them stocked with so many herbs, trees, and animals, adorned with so many seas and mountains. And how must our wonder and admiration be increased when we consider the prodigious distance and multitude of the stars. The Voyager spacecraft are the lineal descendants of those sailing ship voyages of exploration and of the scientific and speculative tradition of Christian Huygens. The Voyagers are caravels bound for the stars and on the way exploring those worlds that Huygens knew and loved so well. One of the main commodities returned on those voyages of centuries ago were travelers' tales, stories of alien lands and exotic creatures that evoked our sense of wonder and stimulated future exploration. There had been accounts of mountains that reached the sky, of dragons and sea monsters, of everyday eating utensils made of gold, of a beast with an arm for a nose, of people who thought the doctrinal disputes among Protestants, Catholics, Jews, and Muslims to be silly, of a black stone that burned, of headless humans with mouths in their chests, of sheep that grew on trees. Some of these stories were true, some were lies. Others had a kernel of truth, misunderstood or exaggerated by the explorers or their informants. In the hands of Voltaire, say, or Jonathan Swift, these accounts stimulated a new perspective on European society, forcing a reconsideration of that insular world. Modern voyagers also return travelers' tales, tales of a world shattered like a crystal sphere, a globe where the ground is covered pole to pole with what looks like a network of cobwebs, tiny moons shaped like potatoes, a world with an underground ocean, a land that smells of rotten eggs and looks like a pizza pie, with lakes of molten sulfur and volcanic eruptions ejecting smoke directly into space, a planet called Jupiter that dwarfs our own, so large that 1,000 Earths would fit within it. The Galilean satellites of Jupiter are each almost as big as the planet Mercury. We can measure their sizes and masses and so calculate their density, which tells us something about the composition of their interiors. We find that the inner two, Io and Europa, have a density as high as rock. The outer two, Ganymede and Callisto, have a much lower density, halfway between rock and ice. But the mixture of ice and rocks within these outer moons must contain, as do rocks on Earth, traces of radioactive minerals which heat their surroundings. There is no effective way for this heat, accumulated over billions of years, to reach the surface and be lost to space, and the radioactivity inside Ganymede and Callisto must therefore melt their icy interiors. We anticipate underground oceans of slush and water in these moons. A hint, before we have ever seen the surfaces of the Galilean satellites close up, that they may be very different one from another. When we do look closely through the eyes of Voyager, this prediction is confirmed. They do not resemble each other. They are different from any worlds we have ever seen before. The Voyager 2 spacecraft will never return to Earth, but its scientific findings, its epic discoveries, its travelers' tales do return. Take July 9, 1979, for instance. At 8:04 Pacific Standard Time on this morning, the first pictures of a new world called Europa, after an old one, were received on Earth.